Our next speaker is our AA speaker for the weekend. One of the toughest spots to fill for this last few years has been to find an AA speaker, and I was not doing really well at that when I got a phone call from Sharon. I had actually been out of town that weekend, but she and a couple other members of the committee had been to the welcome group, and they had heard an AA speaker there. And the way Sharon tells it, the three of them looked at each other and said, "I think we found our AA speaker." And they were so enthusiastic that I'm just really looking forward to hearing whatever she has to share. And with that, I'd like to ask Michelle R. up to share, please.
Hello, everyone. Tansi, my name is Michelle, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michelle.
First of all, I would like to thank Richard and the committee for inviting me to speak, and I would also like to blame Richard for building up my talk. I have a motto in my life: avoid the rush, be disappointed early. So feel free to borrow that if need be. I would like to thank the speakers that have spoken already this weekend, and it's been a wonderful experience to be here. And even though I am here to share my story of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to say that I do believe I am alive today because of the Al-Anon program. So as I talk about my journey of recovery and AA, there will be some Al-Anon stories in there as well, because that's an important part of my life. So to start at the beginning, back when the earth was cooling, I was born in Edmonton to a family of two alcoholic parents. And that's all that I've ever really known, I guess. I've always been surrounded by alcoholics, as have, I guess, many of you. My father was a law student, and my mom was a legal secretary. And things were pretty good, I think, in the first few years of our life, except there was a hint of what was to come when my sister was born the day before me, 2 years later, and I got pneumonia and had to be hospitalized and was sure that I was being traded in for a younger, better model. It was a bit of an omen of things to come, how I would learn how to have resentments very early in my life. My first real memory, I guess, is of my grandfather dying in front of me when we lived in Peace River and we were pouring a patio outside and he had a heart attack and keeled over. And that experience with death was to mark much of my life. Indeed, so much of my journey has been around grieving and loss and how to deal with that in recovery. So that's my first memory, my grandpa keeling over. And after that, my mom's drinking really escalated. My early years were really spent being the responsible one. I remember getting in between my mom and dad when they would be fighting and threatening my dad that I was going to call the police if he didn't stop hitting my mom. I had a little sister as well, as I mentioned, who I was very responsible for. And so I grew up knowing that it was my job to keep everybody safe. When my parents separated when I was six, we moved my sister and I and my mom back to Edmonton. And it was there that I think the final kind of break with my childhood happened. Even though I knew that she was my mom, I really felt like I was the parent in the household. My mom was not a mean drunk. She was a sad drunk. And my job as a child was to get up at night after she'd gone to bed and to make sure that she didn't have a cigarette in her hand when she passed out. It was my job to make sure that the door was locked so that no one could break in. It was my job to make sure that my little sister was covered up and ready to go to sleep. And from time to time, it was my job to make sure that some guy that my mom brought home from the bar knew that it was time to hit the road. So I was a pretty feisty little kid, but I was also scared all the time. Because I knew no one was really looking out for me, that I had to rely on myself much of the time. I did have one rock in my life, and that was my grandma, who I called my nanny. She was my mom's mom, and she was kind of the one who was there for me much of my childhood. But when I was 12 years old, my nanny died. And I realized that feeling of being alone and not having an adult to count on really deepened with her passing. Well, I was just starting to kind of get used to my nanny dying when 8 days later, my mom took a bad turn. She had been doing okay and not drinking since her mom's death until the day of the funeral. On the day of her funeral, she went to bed and didn't get out of bed for about 3 days. Now, some of you will remember, particularly women, back in the day in the 1970s, when women went to their doctors and said, "My life sucks, my husband's not home, or somebody's drinking, or being at home with these kids is driving me crazy," they didn't send you for counseling. They didn't tell you that, yeah, of course your life is stressful. They gave you Valium. That's what happened, and they gave it to you by the handful. And so my mom was laying in bed trying to mourn the loss of her mother with Valium and drinking. And I remember I was having a bath, and she came in to use the washroom, and as she went out the door, she fell, and she died right in front of me. And it was about 2 weeks before my 13th birthday. Again, that sense of sudden death and that having to deal with grief was put upon me. And I really felt totally alone in the world then. My nanny was gone, my mom was gone, and my future was certainly uncertain. I couldn't imagine how I was going to live. Well, for some strange reason, my father, who had remarried a woman that had two kids, had decided that we had to come and live with him, my sister and I. And so they took us away from my stepfather, who was a very good man, and made us go and live with them. So I show up at this place, and I'm 13. And I'm very, very angry. And I'm very confused. And I'm very bereft. I felt totally and utterly abandoned. So I show up in this town with my little sister, and the message in our house is, not only don't feel, the message in our house is, your dad's a big shot. You guys have to behave better than everybody else. Because my dad was a judge. And at that time, in a small city or a small town, being a judge was a big deal. So I decided that I could figure out some creative ways to act out against this commandment that I be the best kid. So I became an excellent shoplifter. And in our school, this new girl came in partway through the year, and I immediately fell in love with her because I could tell she was just a major badass the second she walked in the door. She was beautiful and snotty and miserable, and she just gave off this perfume of disdain, like she hated everything, and I knew immediately she had to be my best friend. And she was my best friend, and she introduced me to the lovely delights of her aunt and uncle's marijuana drawer and liquor cabinet. And that was my introduction to that thing that was going to take me away from myself. Now, anyone who has grown up in an alcoholic family, I'm sure from the time that they can articulate the conscious thought, says to themselves, "I will never be like them. I will never be like them, meaning I will never be an alcoholic. I've never yet met anyone, any kid sitting on Santa's knee who said, I would like to be an alcoholic when I grow up. I've never seen a kid dress up as an alcoholic for Halloween. If you have, feel free to tell me about it after this, but I've yet to meet one. And so it's not something that you want to be. In fact, it's something that you definitely don't want to be. So how did I get there? How did I end up an alcoholic when every fiber of my being in early childhood said I'll never be like them? One clue might be when cold season would come around, and I was sick a lot as a kid, my mom would always make me hot rye toddies. And I started thinking about that. You know, probably giving a six-year-old a lot of hot rye toddies isn't the best way to deal with a cold. And I must admit, during cold season, I still get that little whiff of nostalgia that I can't have a hot rye toddy. So if the rest of you can, I'm very jealous of you. Don't tell me about it. But that's what passed for home medicine in our house, was hot rye toddies when I was a kid. So here I am. I'm a teenager. My mom's dead. My dad doesn't really want me, but because of some warped sense of obligation, I'm living with him. My stepmother really doesn't like me at all. I'm not wanted at all. And the next year after I'd finished school with them when I was 13, they sent me away to private school. If there's any other greater way to tell a kid we don't want you than send you to private school, I don't know what it is. But the message was very clear. We don't want you. So they sent me to private school. Now, private school is a fabulous place to develop your drinking problem. And here's why. Your parents are paying a lot of money for you to go somewhere where they believe people are actually watching you. However, nobody's actually caring about you as long as you're in at curfew time. So we'd have this dean that would come around and she'd open the door and look. And as long as she saw your kind of head there under the blankets at curfew, she really didn't care what you were up to before. So believe me, I got into lots of trouble before curfew. And by the time I was 14, I was well on my way to being alcoholic and to doing drugs. When I was 14, I also discovered another escape called men. And I skipped the boys and I went straight to the men. When I was in grade 9 there in this private school, I was dating a Greek guy who was the head waiter at the Sheraton Hotel in Regina. And at the end of one of our dates, he was taking me back to the school, and he was asking me, what are you going to do in the summer? And I said, well, I'll probably have to, you know, go home and see my parents. And he said, well, no, but what are you going to do after that? Like, are you going to get a job or, you know, go back to school? And I said, well, yeah, I have to go back to school next year. I'm going to be in grade 10. How old are you? He said, 14. That was the end of that. I never saw him again. And that's what I did. I was 14 years old, and I dated 22, 23-year-old guys. And so getting booze and drugs was never a problem for me. Well, clearly my parents saw the writing on the wall that sending me to private school was a waste of their hard-earned money. And so I had to stay with them the next year. And all I can remember about that time living at home with my family was that it was marked by constant conflict, and that everything about who I was and what was important to me was a lie. My mother's background is Métis. So all of her family was dead by the time she died. And I never grew up learning anything about being Métis. The only thing that was ever said to me was by my stepmother, who said to me when I was a teenager, if you don't smarten up, you're going to end up a drunken Indian like your mother. there was no connection to my mother's family, to that side of my heritage. It was seen as something to be ashamed of. And I internalized that, and I was ashamed of who I was. And so I lied, and I got out of the house as much as possible, and I looked for a sense of belonging. And where I looked for that sense of belonging was with men, was with people who were drinking and doing drugs, so that I could get out of my head for a while, so that I could stop the pain. I also admit to feeling quite a bit of guilt that my mom had died and that I was going on living. And you would think that that would inspire me to have a better life than she had, to be in a better place, but it didn't. The pain was so bad, the self-loathing, the sense of abandonment, that I couldn't imagine any other way of living but going on as I did. Somehow I made it through high school. I roomed and boarded with a bunch of different people, but I would always get kicked out because I was too much trouble. And I'm not sure how I passed all my classes, but I did. The closest I came to flunking was actually in typing class. And for those of you who remember actual typewriters, anybody here remember actual typewriters? Yeah. So we had to take typing class. And I hated it. And there was this guy sitting behind me that kind of liked me, and he'd bug me all the time. One day he was bugging me, and I lost my mind totally, lost my religion, and threw the typewriter at him and knocked all the books over. And the typing teacher said, "If you promise to never come back here again, I will pass you with a 51. And that's kind of how I got through a lot of my school, was that way. Just don't darken my door, and I'll pass you. So the first time I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous was when I was 17. I was living in my own apartment. My dad was subsidizing my rent, and I was living in my own apartment because nobody else would let me live with them. And I remember waking up one night, and there were just bodies just strewn all over my little apartment. And some people I knew. Some, I don't even have any clue who you are or how you got in here. I blacked out a lot when I drank, and it scared me. And I'd been getting pressure from some of my school teachers to do something about my drinking. So I phoned AA, and this lovely lady talked to me and said, "I'll pick you up for a meeting tomorrow night." And we made arrangements to meet at a certain time on a certain street corner. And of course, I didn't go, because by the time the next day happened, I had convinced myself that it was okay to carry on as I was. So I'm 17, and I've become what I said I would never become. I'm sticking bottles of beer in my pockets and in my backpack, and I'm taking a little flask of vodka to school so that I can make it through the day. I'm shaking and having DTs by the time I'm 17. And I'm wondering, how did I get here? I have many relationships and no love. My relationships were efforts, I guess, to surround myself with people so that I wouldn't feel alone. And yet I felt alone all the time. Well, I figured out a way to sober up and a way to get all those things that I'd always wanted in my life, which was love and a family and a sense of belonging. And so I did what any good alcoholic girl growing up in a small town does. I got knocked up when I was 17. And at 18, I got married and I had a baby. And I figured that would fix me. I married this nice Catholic boy. He was okay, but I really liked his mom. And I think I honestly married him because I loved his mom so much and I wanted a family. And what better than this ready-made, big, boisterous Catholic family? So I married into this family. My son, at the age of 6 weeks, had to go into the doctor because he was crying and he wasn't gaining weight. And we found out at that time that he was born with irreversible kidney damage. and that his kidneys would continue to deteriorate over the course of his life. So here I am, this 18-year-old who's white-knuckling it dry, not drinking. And my husband is going to school full-time, which means he's at school 8 hours a day and doing 4 hours of homework a night. And we're living in Calgary, and I have no friends. And again, I have this sense of being so alone. I don't have a mom and dad, really, that I can call for support. His mom and dad are far away. And so we enter this parenthood journey with this big weight on us that our son is going to be very ill. We move back to Medicine Hat, which is where his family is from. And at some point, I don't remember when, I start drinking again and I start drugging again. And I am unable to parent my son. And I did all kinds of things that you can only imagine or things that you have experienced. I was not able to be in good relationship with my son, with my husband, with my mother-in-law, who I love so much, because that illness had taken over me again. That disease of loneliness and all the outside things that I did to try and fill that hole hadn't worked. I left my marriage. I left my son. Because I knew that I could not parent him the way that his dad could. So I'm seeing my son on weekends. I'm working part-time. I'm dating. Dating, you know what that means. I'm dating various people. Very quickly, short dates, very short dates. So I'm dating and seeing my son on weekends. And on my weekend, when it's my turn to go and get my son, I go to pick him up at his dad's house. And I'm knocking on the door and knocking on the door. Nobody's answering. So I walk around the back of the house and I look inside, and the house is cleaned out and they've moved away. I was not to have a significant relationship with my son again until he was 16 years old because of that move and because of where I was. And I knew in the depths of my being at that point that I truly was a lost soul. There was nothing left for me to hold on to if I couldn't have him. So, of course, my drinking got a lot worse until I met the next solution in my life, which was my to-be second husband. And we met in a very romantic way. It just brings tears to my eyes when we think about it, when I think about it. We met at a drug buy. That's right, at a drug buy. I was sleeping with his best friend. It just gets better, folks. I'm sleeping with his best friend, and he comes over to buy drugs, and our eyes meet over the acid as the money exchanges hands, and it was love at first sight. So I don't know if any of you have tried this as a way of curing alcoholism or curing what ails you, but I thought if I married an alcoholic and I was the responsible one, then maybe I would be okay. So I married this man, and we had two more children, and the marriage was very bad. He was very abusive, and I was totally filled with resentment and anger all the time. And the reason I believe that Al-Anon saved my life was because we moved here from Alberta for his job. And the night that we moved in, his friend from work helped him and they got drunk. And after his friend left, he beat me up and trashed the house. And I called the police, and the police came and said, well, there's nothing really we can do now. He's gone home. He's gone off. Just let him cool off. It'll be okay. And I knew that if I didn't do something, either leave or find a way to stay and be safe, I wasn't going to make it. And for some reason, Al-Anon popped into my mind. I had known about it. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, I believe, the next night at the Eastview Al-Anon group. And I was not a well person. I walked in there, and these lovely ladies were so nice to me. And they had a beginner group, a 1-2-3 group, where all of us new fish were taken, and you could ask questions and so on. And the only question I had was of these ladies, give me one reason why I shouldn't just stick a knife in his ribs when he's sleeping. Yeah, I think I qualified for Al-Anon. Good, you're laughing. You've had that thought too. Okay, good. All right. So they were very kind, and they just said, keep coming back, dear. It gets better. And I did. And so I went faithfully to Al-Anon for 3 years. And during that time I was in Al-Anon, I was also not drinking. I was sober. Same steps. If you work those darn steps, it's pretty hard to keep drinking, even if you're not in AA. And so I worked the steps of Al-Anon. And life got better. Life got better. The marriage still wasn't great. And a few months before my 30th birthday, I decided that I had to get out or I was going to die. I just knew in my spirit that I couldn't make it if I stayed. And so I left that marriage. And wouldn't you know it, I started experiencing a lot of stress. And, you know, I had this ex-husband who was phoning me, and he was suicidal, and he was threatening me, and, you know, I was living on social assistance with these two kids, and one of my kids had autism and had pretty significant disability, and so I spent a lot of my time with her, and we were very bonded, and so I had these kids and that I was trying to take care of. So what did I do to deal with my stress? I went back to that thing that I know that takes away my emotional pain. So I started drinking again. Not a lot, I told myself. A few glasses of wine here and there at night when the kids went to sleep. I wasn't out running around the bars. I wasn't getting into trouble with my drinking. I thought I would be okay. At this time, when I'm still kind of floating around the edges of Al-Anon, I went to the Saskatoon Roundup here that occurs in February. And I did what I often do. I met a man. It's hard to believe now looking at me, but I was totally hot. Like, I had, like, lots of guys. That's all I'm saying. You just have to envision skinnier, younger me, and it works for you. So I met a man, and I met him at the Roundup, and we started talking, and we started dating, and he was so nice. Like, he was just the nicest man. And he had those two qualities that I know as an Al-Anon person I looked for in a man. He was walking upright, and he was sober. So basically, he was my dream man. I mean, what else do you want, right? So I meet this man, and we start dating, and we're dating for a little while. And one day, he has the nerve to say to me, I'm going to have to break up with you, I think, because I really like you, but I think you have a drinking problem. Wow, was I insulted. I couldn't believe. What is this guy talking about? I thought he was so smart. He's clearly an idiot. Like, what is he talking about? I don't have a drinking problem. He hadn't really even seen me drinking. What was he talking about? But I wasn't quite ready to cut him loose. So I thought, I'll show him. I'll show that bugger. I'm going to go to AA and I'll prove that I'm not an alcoholic. They're clearly going to see that I'm just an Al-Anon person. They're going to kick me out. They won't want me hanging around their meetings. And so I went. I went to an AA meeting. Now, I was a pretty well-functioning alcoholic. I walk into my first AA meeting. Two guys get into an argument, and one throws coffee at the other one, and I'm thinking, and these people are supposed to help me? Are you freaking kidding me? These people are insane. I wasn't sure I ever wanted to go back and hang around with these lunatics. But I did. I tried it for a little while, and I hated every single minute of AA. In fact, I hated it for close to 5 years. But I started to have the feeling that maybe I belonged. And I also had a realization that there was a reason why I wasn't quite as nice as all the people in my Al-Anon group. I'd always... I'd always wondered why the women there were so much nicer than me and, you know, kinder and gentler and, you know, why I didn't quite fit in. And it was starting to make a little bit of sense why I didn't fit in quite so well. So I'm going to these meetings and I'm not really liking them and I'm not liking the people. And I'm rejecting the fellowship of people in the program and I'm definitely rejecting the fellowship of God. I had no use for God when I came into AA, none whatsoever. In the past, in my early childhood, I had had times when I had been intensely religious and connected to a faith community because I was looking for answers and, again, looking for that sense of belonging. And that was really ended for me early in my marriage, before we moved here, when after a particularly rough time in my life, my husband was drinking a lot and drugging. He was hitting me a lot. Our daughter had just been diagnosed with autism. And I went to the pastor of the church that I attended. And I finally had the courage to tell him what was going on behind closed doors at our house. He listened to me and he said, "Michelle, clearly you're too assertive for your husband. And you need to learn to be quiet and to do what he tells you to do, and then he won't be so mad. That's the way that God wants you to be in your marriage." I knew in my heart that God couldn't want that, but I also knew that I could no longer be part of a community that believed that. And so that connection that I had to other people, that spiritual connection, that faith community, was lost to me. And God and I had a parting of the ways, and we didn't meet each other again for a long time. So I'm in AA, not really sure I'm an alcoholic, don't like the people. Basically there to get a guy. And the reason I say that is because sometimes we hear people say in meetings, you have to be ready or you have to hit your bottom or it's not going to work unless you really want to be there for yourself. And that wasn't my experience. I didn't want to be there for myself. I didn't think I had hit bottom. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. But there was something about going to AA. There was something about being present. There was something about setting my mind on the 12 steps. There was something about being loved, even when I couldn't love myself, that kept me there and that eventually led to a sense of belonging. And so I tell people, it doesn't matter why you get here, either to Alcoholics Anonymous or to Al-Anon. It doesn't matter if the court orders you, or your partner threatens you to go, or you go because you don't want your child to end up like you did. The intention might be different for all of us, but sometimes you just show up and the miracle happens. So I stuck it out in AA and I stayed sober. I went back to school. My husband went back to school. My son came to live with me, which would sound like a wonderful blessing and a thing to rejoice over, except he was 16. And the way he came to live with us was he'd been staying with us for part of the summer, and he left. And about 5 days after the little turkey left, we got the phone bill where he'd run up $600 in phone bills to his girlfriend in Winnipeg. So as we're cursing him out, his dad phones and says, Tyler's not doing so well here. Can he come and live with you? And I said, sure. Because this was my chance to parent my son in the way that I couldn't do when he was little. So here we are. We get married. Two drunks. Three kids. One has autism. One's a miserable teenager. The other one's a miserable teenager. Life was not fun in our house for a long time. It was very difficult. But because of the 12 steps of AA, we were able to hang in there. We were able to get support. Well, we did go back to school, and I went into social work because, hey, I'm an adult child, right? I got to help people. You might as well get paid for it. That's what I figured. So I went into social work, and I got a social work degree. And life was ticking along pretty good. Still wasn't too wild about the God thing, but I'd kind of, you know, gotten accustomed to the AA thing, right? It's like mold in your bathroom, right? First it's just a few dark spots, and then it spreads. But by then you're okay with it. And then that's kind of how I felt about the fellowship of AA, you know? It was okay. At least it was my mold, you know? It was my crazy people. So we're living life, we're parenting, we're doing all the things that people do. And then the unthinkable thing happens, and I think for all of us who have children, it is the unthinkable thing. On March 23rd, 1994, I went downstairs, not 1994, 2004, I went downstairs to get my daughter Rachel up for bed, and she was dead. She had died in her sleep. And we'll never really know why she died. Our best guess is that she had a seizure. She was 17 years old. I can't adequately tell you how much that child was the center of my world. If any of you are lucky and blessed enough to have relationships with people with disabilities, you'll know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, I also use the word normies. If you just know normies, I'm sorry for you. You should get a better quality of friends. But that child was the grounding center of my life. Everything good that I was, everything good that I had learned to do, I thought was because of her. When you lose a child, people say to you, I could never make it if that happened to me. I couldn't live. I wouldn't be able to live if that happened to me. And the reality is that you can, and you do, and I did. I did live. I lived because by then Marty and I had another daughter, so we had a little five-year-old at home. I did because I had grown children and grandchildren. I had to live. But I really didn't want to. People ask me, did you think about drinking? Not really. No. Because I knew that there was nothing that drinking would do to either bring Rachel back or to honor her life. And honoring her life became the most important driving force for me to keep going, to get out of bed every day and to do what I needed to do. So I didn't really think about drinking. But I definitely thought about dying a lot. Every time I saw a train or a bridge, I thought about driving my car into that train or driving off the bridge. I got really good at driving around with the tears streaming down my face so I couldn't see. And I've never, ever experienced pain like that in my life. It was so bad, I thought it would kill me. I really did. But I went on living because I had to. And I also had to face a big decision about what I was going to do about this God thing now that this had happened. I knew I had a choice. On the one hand, I could believe in this idea of a higher power that just decided for some reason that my daughter needed to die. I could believe in this idea of a God who said, this kid lives and this kid dies and it doesn't make any sense and too bad for you. Or I thought, I could think of a higher power that was also brokenhearted with me. A God of my understanding that said, I'm sorry. I didn't want her to die either, but I will walk along this path with you. And I don't really know why I chose this way, but I did. It's such a freeing thing to stop hating God. And I encourage you. People say a lot of stupid stuff about God. They really do. They say a lot of dumb crap, right? The freedom that the 12 steps give us to develop a God of our own understanding, a God who is not capricious, a God who does not blame and torture some and give others a free ride. That has been, I think, the biggest gift of my sobriety, is falling into relationship with a God that is worthy of my love and my trust. And I have that today. Well, because I'm an alcoholic, and if any of you know some of the readings from the big book, it says half measures availed us nothing. I went from hating God or being annoyed by God or apathetic towards God to deciding that I should become a minister because that's the way I roll. So after Rachel died, I started going to church and looking for that sense of meaning and that connection. And I started getting this niggly kind of feeling in the back of my head. This little voice all the time would say, that should be you up there. That should be you serving communion. That should be you baptizing babies. That should be you doing that. Which to me was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard in my life. Really me. That's the best you got, God. Really me. You want me to be a minister. Like, you're so tapped out of of nice people. Like, you don't have any nice people that can do this, right? I thought that was the most inappropriate thing I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, I don't really like people. I'm not nice. You know, I don't run around saying godly things all the time. Why me, God? Us in the business call it the call. And I was clearly getting the call. And I decided that I had to do something about this. So I met with a friend of mine, and I told her I was experiencing this call. And she's also an AA member who's a minister. And I said, I don't think I can do this. I'm not good enough. What would God want me to do? And her answer really was important for me and still is. Her answer was this. I don't believe that God calls us in spite of our weaknesses. I believe that God calls us because of our weaknesses. And that made sense to me. There's a saying that is really important to me, and Marty, write this down. I want it on my gravestone. Ernest Hemingway, who was kind of a drunk and a misogynist, so I'm just reclaiming his words and using them in a good way, but he said, the world breaks everyone, and after many are strong at the broken places. And I would have to say that that has been my journey of recovery. I am strong at the broken places, and I have many, many broken places. And those broken places are what God uses today in my life to be with people. If you ever thought that people who are in the God business or religious are wonderfully perfect people, we're not. We're as screwed up as everybody else. All I do is try to journey with people through those important things of their life. And that's what I get to do. And that is the most wonderful part of my life, is what I get to do. And I get to do that a lot. I get to sit with people when people are dying. I get to celebrate marriages, and for someone who's been married 3 times, to say good luck and God bless you, that's a big step for me to do that. I get to baptize babies. I get to hear fifth steps. I get calls sometimes from people that say, my son or daughter is having a hard time with drinking or drugs. That laughter I had, God, you know, in response to God calling me, that laughter, I still laugh today. But the laughter today is in gratitude and in a sense of wonder. How does the program change someone like me into a person that's just willing to keep trudging that road of happy destiny? My whole life was about being abandoned, alone, not looking or looking constantly for a sense of belonging. And now today, most of the time, I have the sense that I belong to God, that I belong here in these rooms, that I belong to the human race, and that I do matter, and I am important. I'm not that little girl hiding anymore under the bed and waiting for the screaming to stop. I just want to finish by saying a little bit about the theme, Together We Can Make It. Out of all the things that I've experienced in my life, and some of them have been really terrible, the thing that's come to me, the truth that's been evident time and time again, is that, as Joy said, there is healing in that circle. It is in that circle that we are strong. And it is in that circle of love and fellowship and acceptance that we see ourselves reflected in love in one another's eyes. That's what sobriety, recovery, has brought to me. That reflection of love in your eyes. That reflection of God's love in your eyes. And if you don't see that reflection on a daily basis, then find somewhere that you can get that. Together we can make it. Yes, together we can. Together we are strong in the broken places. And may that always be so for each one of you. Thank you.